Good to see you.
Bye. Good luck.
Seeing always the dual male personality in anything you do, in Equus, the patient and the psychiatrist, and Pizarro, the...
And the Inca.
The Inca, yes, and, yes, the, yeah, and yes, so on, and I guess...
And I suppose this, now again.
Mozart, yeah, and Salieri and so on.
Yes, yeah, a psychiatrist did write a long and, to me, tedious piece about the fact that there's a twin obsession in Orban's work. I find this very, as I say, it's sort of silly. I think Sagatti's writing an awful lot of rubbish about art, and I can't take it seriously. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's his way of earning a living, and mine is to write plays. You know,
yeah.
You know, I don't really feel that.
Well,
I mean, you know, the funny thing about Equus, really, in terms of the success it had in London and New York, was that in London it was considered scandalous or sensational or whatever, worth talking about, because it was allegedly cruel to horses, and in New York, because it was allegedly cruel to psychiatrists.
Neither of which can defend themselves.
No. Oh, psychiatrists can. They never stop. Horses can't.
Right. Have you had a particularly bad experience with a psychiatrist that would lead you to a kind of animosity for their profession?
No, I just... do not believe. No, I have had no contact with them at all. I once went for an afternoon to a psychotherapist, but that hardly counts. I've had no personal contact with them at all. I just really believe that, certainly living as I do in New York, it does seem to me that for many years psychiatrists have dominated the city in the wrong way. It seems to me that people, on the whole, must take much more responsibility for their own experience, for authenticating their experience and for living by it, and not always running to counselors to say what you really do, what you really mean is X, Y, and Z. I think this is awful. I don't say that psychiatrists cannot help deeply disturbed people. Of course they can. I wouldn't be so sweeping or so foolish. But it does seem very dangerous if you are going to run about trying to unlock all doors with the same little key, particularly the same little Freudian key. I just can't be doing with it, you know. It seems to me wrong. I actually had someone say to me the other day, my doctor tells me I'm still in love with my wife. It's one of the most obscene things I've ever heard anybody say. You know, I mean, that's it taken to its extremity, but you do see what I mean. I mean, there's something,
yes,
quite clearly wrong about a society in which a very organized, professional gentleman can actually turn to me and say that. He didn't know himself, but his doctor told him it was.
Yes, it's like, well, it has...
What was his experience worth?
It goes along with he thinks he's happy until someone tells him he isn't or something.
So I'm not too hot about them now.
In connection with that, there was, the play Equus, you had a psychiatrist, and many people found the philosophy of that play loathsome, in that or repellent, in that the idea that the passion of the madman was superior to the drab, everyday, sane life of the psychiatrist, and that he somehow envied the madman his madness because it was passionate and vital and so forth.
Yes, but I think they got that wrong. That's not what the play was saying. The play, I didn't cheat, at least I didn't think I cheated. I didn't say that the boy was in a kind of rosy, happy state most of the time. He was clearly shown as having nightmares every night. He was in desperate need of some kind of help. Yeah. The doctor's problem is that any tragic situation is not a conflict between a clear right and a clear wrong, otherwise we'd know how to behave. It was between two different kinds of right. Any doctor faced with a patient having nightmares has to, in fact, relieve him of the condition which is causing the nightmares. He has to relieve distress.
Right.
But he cannot avoid the conclusion that this is basically, in terms of the source of his ecstasy, the boy's ecstasy, all the boy has, and that in removing it, he will well remove that too. He goes right ahead and does it. He has to. But, you know, I mean, all drama must, like all life, deal with ambiguity. It's not a straight one thing or another.
Not as easy as that.
No, yeah. No. I mean, the boy himself has, in fact, destroyed his own sense of worship and been driven by his worship to abominable acts. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that society in that way is guiltless. His parents are, if anything, stand accused, not of anything very serious on a social level, a total lack of imagination, as much of his society stands accused of. It's a very flat, uninteresting, suburban, lower middle class life that he's leading. And, you know, that is obviously that a defunct church is not going to supply anything for him. He doesn't have much, as the doctor says, he has no history, he has no art, he has no literature, he has very little to feed him. and he, out of his desperate need to some state of being cry in some form, O Magnum Mysterium, does that. All the trim, exact, and practical, but rather spiritually dead psychiatrists do is to perceive that in some areas, Alan Strang is richer and more endowed by his need of worship than he, Dr. Dysart, is.
Yeah.
And realizes that in the proper, humane pursuit of his career, and not career, in his profession, has to remove that. That seems to me a tragic dilemma. It is not. Uh-huh. It's not me saying long live mad people. You know, I don't do your own thing. I hated it.
That's how it was perceived in some.
I know. A lot of young people would say to me, "Oh, right on." You know, that play saying is do your own thing, and I would say I don't believe you should do your own thing. Would you say to Jack the Ripper, "Do your own thing"? Of course not. It's too easy that. You know.
Some people would though.
Of course. Oh yes.
You're one of the handful of respectable people that I know about who has taken LSD. Was that in an attempt to learn anything about yourself?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
How did that work?
Well, I really only took it once. Actually, I took it a couple more times, but it seemed to me the same experience repeating, so I didn't really get very interested in it. But I did take it once, and with people who had taken it and looked after me, and I was very in need, I think, of some fresh insights. This was in 1966, quite some time ago now. And I had an extraordinary experience under it. Yes, I had a... I hate this word trip. It sounds so frivolous and stupid. But it was a racial experience. I seemed to go back through the stages of civilization or of history, and I saw myself, the genetic links through history, back through ancient times, through medieval times and ancient times, and right back to as it seemed to me, the Bronze Age. I had an evolutionary experience as well as a cultural one. And then I also had a racial one later in the day. I had a very clear picture of myself in a mirror as belonging to where indeed my ancestors did come from, Russia, and a ghetto in Russia, Jewish ghetto in Russia. And I had an extraordinarily particular vision of the suffering figures of Jewish figures in the ghetto and the Cossacks and the whole horror of what I suppose it had been like to be some of my ancestors. And I had no real conscious notion of this until then. Ultimately, you cannot say this was reality, but it seemed to me to have the force of reality very strongly, and it very much changed my thinking about existence.
What led you to do it in the first place? Did you have some friends who had said this is going to be important for you, or this?
Yes, I had, and I had read Huxley and all the books at that time, and I was very tempted to, by it. I felt a deep need to do it. I can't quite tell you why. I think it was a need to widen one's own experience. And you know, we all have this feeling that the brain, having so many thousands of cells, that we're slightly not using them all, and that some more can be activated by a drug. I think it's like Moses going up the mountain. I think you go up once on the drug. Thereafter, you have to work for it. To re-earn and validate the insights. I don't think you can just go on taking it as a martini.
Some people have been unhinged by it. Did that worry you, or did you think you should have a doctor nearby?
It does, I think, yes. I think anybody who values their brains would be worried by the possibilities of doing it, and I think it shouldn't be. It's like Russian roulette. I mean, I think you could have a very bad experience. You don't know what particular cells are going to be activated. I wouldn't, you know, make a great practice of this. But it seems to me that all experiences of this kind are useful for
writers.
Yes, I think so. Provided you use it as an adjunct to your life, not as a way of life.
You've had the blessing of very good directors. Do you ever take issue with them? Can you think of times when you've said you're ruining my play, or you don't understand my scene, or I won't allow that?
No, I don't think one actually... I mean, I've been lucky enough to work with some of the world's greatest directors. I've worked with John Dexter many times, three times in three different plays, and Peter Hall twice, and John Gielgud on my first play, Five Finger Exercise. And I think if you're lucky to work with those people, you're also, on the whole, sensible. If you work out a proper relationship with them where you don't have those absurd confrontation scenes, which the one's always reading about, how dare you, and you've ruined my play. Well, I mean, I don't think one would ever get to that stage.
Could you veto an actor, for example, if they think
you're
writing?
Oh, yes. I think you can't. I mean, no director worth his salt is going to actually work with an actor whom the author actively thinks wrong for a part or dislikes for any reason. But I think that you also, after entrusting a manuscript to a fine and proven director, you have to allow them a great deal of leeway. Otherwise, they'll, you know, if they're worried all the time that the author's frowning at their all through rehearsal, saying, then it's never going to happen. I think you've got to trust them to do that.
We're almost completely out of time, and I wondered if I was intrigued by something you said about the scene, the nude scene in Equus would have been more erotic if the actors were not nude.
Oh, indeed, it would. The last scene of Equus, the nude scene, was the anti-erotic scene in the play. It was clinical. As you notice, as they took their clothes off, the lights got brighter, and they were standing in a dead white light in a surgical thing. The erotic scene in that play is the end of the first act, and that would not work if the boy was naked.
I see.
It was intentionally anti-erotic. It didn't stop the firemen and the policemen coming in every night at 10 past 10 to have a look at it.
They did?
Oh, yes. It was the moment I usually left the theatre. And that sounds very disingenuous of me. Yeah. It's honest of me, but it was true.
Thank you, Peter Shaffer.
Thank you very much.
See you next time. Good night.